Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
And welcome to a special edition of Mental Health Monday for World Suicide Prevention Day. My name is Mick Coyle, and here at Radio City Talk, we consider it a really important thing to talk about mental health, and particularly on a day like today, as we highlight the attempts right around the world to reduce the number of people taking their own lives. Later on in the programme, we're going to be hearing about the work that goes on in the Liverpool City region as they adopt the Zero Suicide Alliance's policy of trying to reduce suicides down to zero. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of people have got to work together, but at a special summit held in Liverpool, a commitment has been made to try and make that a possibility. That's later in the programme. First up though on the programme, I've been invited down to James's Place, which is a brilliant, brilliant centre based in Liverpool's Georgian Quarter. It is set up with one thing in mind, to try and reduce the number of young men who take their own lives. As part of the trip, I got a full tour of the wonderful facilities they've got there. I met one of the therapists and also the centre manager to hear some more about the fantastic work which is ongoing. James's Place is a brilliant facility. Liverpool is very lucky to have it, but actually if it proves to be a success, hopefully it can be something that can be replicated right around the country. Here's what happened when I visited.
Hello, hi Mick, welcome to James's Place.
Thank you, thanks for having me. Absolutely. So here we are inside James's Place. Bridget is the centre coordinator and she's going to guide us through. We're actually in one of the really prestigious buildings in Liverpool's Georgian Quarter. Fantastic building which has been done up over multiple floors to become James's Place. We step into the first area, which is a reception area where people might meet and get together. Bridget, this is such a great space, isn't it? And already it's a really relaxed vibe.
Yeah, the vibe we're going for is quite homey. So it feels like you're stepping into a home instead of into a clinical environment. That's what, like, with all the white and the soft furnishings, because a lot of mental health facilities are they're in a porter cabin at the back of the building and they're just really damp, and you can tell that it seems like people don't care about the people going to get mental health help. But we really wanted it to feel like somewhere where people feel valued and it's a safe, comforting environment.
And actually, as we just step through into the, in my house we call it the back room, it's a little bit grander than that. There's just some images on the wall here of what the building actually looked like, and it gives you a sense of the amount of work which has gone in with no room, no plaster on the walls, trying to bring all the fireplaces back up, wires hanging down as well. It's been an incredible investment that they've made into this building.
Yeah, it's so admirable, and that so much care has been put into every single detail just to make it so amazing to be here.
Now, there's a plaque here in the first room that we've entered. James's Place, opened by His Royal Highness, the Duke of Cambridge, on the 19th of June 2018. Prince William came to open the door, and there was a lot of people here as well. A real sense that this was a real moment for Liverpool, but also a real moment for the family, for James's family as well.
Yeah, so it made us feel that people really believed in us, and that it came from this idea and this dream, and that coming and it being opened by someone who's got so much influence, just, you know, really putting us on the map and making it feel really real and valued and important.
And of course, for James's mum, who has obviously worked so hard, the family overall have worked so hard to make this place happen. They've not just done this on the cheap or just thought, oh, we'll try Liverpool and we'll see what happens. They've made major investments into Liverpool, the facility, and we can look out towards the garden as well. This is a brilliant space. This must be like a space like no other anywhere else in the country.
Well, we're the first one. We're the first centre like this in the country. And we're really intended to be the flagship, you know. It's that, so like, no, nothing was spared. This wasn't like a kind of, oh, we'll just throw something in Liverpool and we'll do it over a couple of months. This has been years of hard work and raising money. And, you know, like James's brother, Harry, who did the Row for James, where they raised like £500,000. This wasn't just a kind of, oh, you know, we'll just do a little bit of mental health stuff and we'll put it in Liverpool. This is something that people really cared about, and the James's family really care about, and have managed to put so much of their heart and their soul into this building, but into this entire organisation.
Often people who work within mental health as well work within, you know, office environments or clinical environments as well. And I must say, absolutely, that's not the case here at all. We're almost, we could be in an interior design magazine here, can't we, in terms of the soft furnishing, the couching, even the flooring, the way the walls are painted as well. There's no sense at all that this is a clinical environment.
Yeah, and you can tell when we have people coming in who've been referred or people who are visiting, that you can see people just relieved to be somewhere that's just so safe and warm, as opposed, because if people haven't really looked into us, they don't know where they're going. They just know, oh, we're going to James's place, and it could be anything, but that they get to come in somewhere that's just so beautiful.
So we're going to hear about the therapy that goes on here, but for you as a person, as a human being as well, do you get that when you see people come through the door that they think, oh, thank goodness, this isn't a clinical space, this isn't, you know, white walls, this isn't like being in a hospital type place, this is a house, this is a home, I can feel at home here, I can open up here.
Yeah, because a lot of our people come through A&E, so they've come through that experience of being in an office in a busy hospital, it's a distressing environment, and to come somewhere that's really calm, you know, but there's not loads of people around here, there'll only be the therapists and then the centre coordinators, and then there'll be volunteers, that it's somewhere that's just really calm and it's quite quiet, and the location, even though we're right in the middle of town, is just so peaceful that it just feels... I can see that when people come in that they're just like, oh, thank God, I'm not in a dingy office, so in a high-rise or something.
No, absolutely. And I guess actually even coming through the front door, people could hear the traffic outside as I came through. But now we look out to the garden as well, and as we speak now, it's a really dull, it's raining at the moment, there's clouds absolutely everywhere. But even outside, the colours in the garden, the flowers are bright and popping and visual as well. So every sort of square foot has been thought of, and the whole area has been sort of considered in terms of how it's going to look.
Yeah, there's every single detail has been looked at. Nothing, it's kind of, we wanted the garden to be somewhere that people could go to reflect, and that it's a peaceful environment, and that, which you can tell if you go out there. I know that it's raining right now, so we kind of, maybe not, but that it's, we've got a water feature that is just, it was just a really calm, like white noise, a bit of peace in the middle of a big city, and it's just, yeah, it's great.
My name's Daniel Crossy, and I'm one of the psychological therapists here at James's Place.
Thanks for inviting us here today. We've already seen what a great space it is and what a great building it is. It could win all the awards in the world for interior design, but I guess for you, it's about making this space work for the reason that James's Place is here. Just tell us about how creating these environments, and we're currently in one of your therapy suites and therapy rooms. How does that aid you in doing your work?
Sure, I suppose what we want is to have like a human environment. We don't want a clinical environment where it feels very medicalized. We want men sort of coming here to be treated as individual human beings going through difficulties, which anyone can go through. So we tried to kind of get away from the clinical approach, get away from the kind of hospitalized environment, and have an environment where it's very normalizing. Come here, you know, the men can come here, feel relaxed, and not feel like their problems are something that is maybe a disorder of some kind. We're trying to get away from labels and diagnoses and categories of mental health, and trying to be sort of get away from that and actually treat someone as an individual person who's had certain things happen to them. And we are here really to help that person explore in a relaxed way exactly how they've got to where they've got to and make sense of it. And that's quite a powerful thing.
I mean, in terms of the people who find themselves sitting in this room as well, we've got sofas and chairs. You get multiple people who could sit in this room as well.
Yes.
When these individuals are at their most vulnerable, and they may well be, and that might well be the reason that with you at James's Place, that environment of togetherness, that you can actually have more than one person in a room at a time, is that helpful?
That's a big part of the James's Place approach, is that we want to get supporters involved. So if there is someone who's struggling, let's say with a suicidal crisis, we want to identify a supporter for them. And that might be a partner, it might be a family member, it might be a friend, it's someone that they can trust. And it's really down to the man coming in, whether they want that supporter to be involved and actually sit in the sessions, or maybe sit in a couple of the sessions, but just be there for the person. And one of the kind of main reasons also to have a supporter is we want potentially to have a support network to help that person stay safe. So maybe when someone does come here, they are feeling very suicidal, they feel very trapped, they don't want to, a part of them doesn't want to go on. We want to, in the early stages of the intervention, to make sure they are safe. So it's really beneficial to have a supporter who can be a part of a safety plan, so when they go home that there is no risk. Maybe that supporter will remove access to any lethal means in the house that they could use to potentially have a suicide attempt. Or the supporter could be involved in a kind of, you know, in an emotional supportive way, in that if that person starts to get these kind of thoughts and these unpleasant thoughts and feelings about not wanting to be here, maybe a part of the plan would be that they would go and they would contact the supporter and the supporter would come around, or if they live with the supporter, they'd have a bit of a conversation about it. So that would be sort of a part of our kind of person-centered framework, you know. So we've got these rooms that are big enough that can facilitate a supporter being there. So we try to make it as comfortable as possible and have enough room and space if there is. And there might be more than one supporter, you know, we might have a whole family in, you know.
You're obviously trained in terms of the therapy that you do, and the sure. people who you would be speaking to are incredibly vulnerable and a very difficult place within their lives as well.
Sure.
If a member of the public heard one of these conversations, would they be shocked by what they were hearing? Are these... They're such serious conversations, sure. and they're high risk in many sure. ways because of the nature of the individual.
Sure.
You know, I wonder when people would look at the environment and think, oh, isn't this a nice place to be? But
sure.
it must be very difficult to have those conversations. They must be very difficult conversations to have.
Yeah. I mean, from the perspective of someone looking in, I think they probably wouldn't be as surprised by some of the content that they're hearing, the content of a person's difficulties, the content of the kind of thoughts that person's having. I think there's an aspect of they're all kind of normal in a way. It's all, we're all on a spectrum and we all have different struggles and different difficulties. But I think a lot of the time guys come here and they think that they are the only ones who have these kind of horrible thoughts about what's going on in their lives, or maybe different anxieties, or feeling uncomfortable, or feeling like they don't have a place in society, or they don't belong to anything. These are the kind of things that most people go through, and it's a part of being human. And that's the beauty of something like this, is they can come here and they can realise that actually their difficulties are shared by other people, and that's part of our approach. But at the same time, of course, it is very, it's a very emotional, very intense conversations. Obviously, when someone comes in here and maybe it's the first time they've ever spoken about the fact that they've actually struggled with, you know, thoughts of wanting to end their lives, and maybe it's been like that for a while. Maybe they've had that for a number of months, or maybe it's been years, but it's come for, you know, every now and again they get experiences of you know, where life is so distressing that they want to kill themselves, you know, and that's obviously quite a hard conversation. But from my perspective as a therapist, I absolutely love it. You know, I find it a privilege to sit and listen, and for someone to trust me enough to, you know, share those kind of thoughts with me. I find a privilege, and I don't find that I don't find it difficult. You know, I find it uplifting in a weird way.
Can I ask you about time?
Sure.
Because one of the things we often talk about when we talk about people who need therapy and counselling, that they need the intervention, the kind of intervention that you provide here at James's Place, one of the themes that often comes up is about how much time that you might get with an individual in a room at any one time,
sure.
How quickly you can get that intervention,
sure.
and also how long a period of time that those meetings and therapy sessions will take place.
Sure.
At the moment, obviously, you're just starting out.
Yes.
I imagine your diary's slightly easier to manage.
Absolutely.
Is that something you're going to absolutely protect, though, that ability to have the amount of time that the individual needs, as opposed to, well, here's a slot and you can fill this slot for this amount of time?
Yeah, our priority is seeing these men within a couple of days that they're referred to us. That's going to be our priority. So we want to see these guys, hopefully, within the next day. You know, if it's a weekend, it might be a couple of days, but we want to really get that early intervention. That's the crux of how this intervention works. Because a lot of, you know, there'll be people that we will see here who just having the conversation, a bit of psychoeducation, a bit of explanation as to how they've got to where they've got to, and the kind of stuff that we talked about before, getting it early makes such a big impact. Because if it's 6 months down the line or a year down the line, not only do we not know if that person would be alive, we also know that that person's mental health problems could deteriorate a lot further. And at the moment, if you go to your GP and you want help with depression or something like anxiety, you will have to wait about six months sometimes to kind of get like a CBT appointment or an assessment, which is still really good. But that period of time can be quite important, you know, that those 6 months can make a big difference. So I think that seeing people early is the key. In terms of how long the sessions are, it will be standard 45 minute to an hour sessions, because we can't sit and spend 2 hours with someone and at the expense of seeing someone else later. We've got to see them early. But also, in terms of like spending that 45 minutes to an hour, what we want to do here, we don't want to foster dependency. We want to empower this person to get better through their own skills and resources. And
I was going to ask you about that. So, because, you know, you got the chair. Once you get out of the chair, you walk back down the stairs, step out through the front door.
Sure.
I guess that's one of the things that you want to do. You use the phrase empower there.
Sure.
To make sure that that person is okay up until maybe the next session.
Absolutely.
Or that they take the next step. So that's I guess that's signposting or doing things internally with an individual to make them think differently about themselves and the world around them.
Absolutely. So you mentioned internally as well. That would be, if we did a safety plan with someone, we'd be thinking about what could be the internal coping strategies they could use first. Because if someone comes here and they can go home and they go through a bit of a crisis, they go through a bit, they get some uncomfortable thoughts. If they can work out internally to use their own resources, maybe it's distraction techniques, maybe it's, you know, something that they're interested in that can distract their mind for a bit. If they can think that they can actually manage it themselves, that is much more empowering than, you know, oh, I'll ring back James's place and I'll speak to the therapist again. That might make me feel good as a therapist that I'm in the helper role, but is it going to be helpful for that person in the long term? So we want to empower that person to use almost like a hierarchy. So it'd be internal coping strategies first. And then maybe if that doesn't work, we could be moving on to the next step where maybe they try and contact a friend, but they wouldn't necessarily mention that they're going through a suicidal crisis or they're struggling with their mental health or whatever. It might just be a case of go out, meet a friend who they know makes them feel better, and that would be like an external distraction. And we'd go through all the different sort of levels that they could use if they're struggling before later on, maybe if things are obviously getting worse, we'd want to make sure that person's safe. So it would be, you know, maybe phone an actual agency, maybe it would be the Samaritans, or maybe it would be actually speaking to a mental health professional, maybe it would be speaking to us at that point. But we want that person to use their own skills first, because that's going to be important down the line. So we don't want to foster that dependency, because that's not helpful for the person in the long run.
Each of the rooms got obviously chairs, sofas, but there's also a kettle, tea and biscuits. And sometimes, you know, we sort of scoff, don't we, about when in crisis we turn to tea and biscuits. But
For
the fact that it's in there,
yes,
tells you that there's a reason why,
yes,
as a nation, when in doubt,
yes,
we turn to tea and biscuits.
Yes. And you know what? It's a good sort of first icebreaker. Someone comes in and you say, would you like a tea or a coffee? You know, do you want a biscuit? I think that's kind of that's the universal sort of British way of calming people down, you know. So we've got, again, that human approach is key. So I think that's probably the first thing people notice when they come into the room, is the rich teas and digestives rather than the interior design of the rooms.
Thank you for sharing your story, and thanks for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Hi, my name is Jane Boland, and I'm the centre manager here at James's Place.
Jane, thank you so much for the invite today. It's been an absolute pleasure to take a look around this place and to sort of see and hear about some of the work that you're doing here. You'll be saving lives through the life of James's Place as well. This is going to be such a valuable facility for Liverpool, and I'm sure one which will be copied right across the country.
I think we already have saved lives, Mick. I think we've already started seeing men, and we've been working with Mersey Care, and they've referred some men who've been really struggling. And I think we've made a difference already. It's our dream that this is something that gets replicated across the country. We've got to bed ourselves in here and get everything working, you know, slick and you know, get what we're up to. But I think we've made a great start. You've met a couple of the team. You've been here. You know what it feels like to be here. I feel that this place is like having another therapist. You know, there's like me as a therapist, and then the building's a therapist as well. There's two of us working together to support the men who are using this centre.
But even yourself, as the centre manager, I said, you know, have you got an office? No, I don't have an office. You know, it's not about creating that environment.
No, I don't have an office. None of us do. We, you know, this is a house. This is a homely, you know, we it's not enough to say it's a homely environment. This is a house. This is James's Place. You know, It's not an office. We don't have an office.
It's a great name as well, and James's parents as well, who've worked so hard to make this place a reality. How much are they in contact with you in terms of what's going on day to day, or do they leave kind of the specialist to it, if you like?
They have given us the mandate to deliver the service here, and they have, you know, they make me feel like they are confident in what we're doing. However, we talk to them, you know, they talk to us every week. Claire's down next week. This is something that is a labour of love for her and Nick. So, yes, you know, they know that from sort of in terms of the therapy that we're delivering, that they trust myself and Dan and the new therapists who we'll be getting soon. They trust what we're doing, but they are very, very much involved in the day-to-day sort of business of James's Place, yeah.
On the day-to-day front, just tell us about referrals and how people actually find themselves sitting inside James's Place.
So we are starting slowly, and in the first instance, sort of right now, people are coming to us having been seen in our local A&E at the Royal. And if they're seen at the Royal and the team there think that this is a good alternative for them, they give us a ring and we have that discussion and the guys can come along that day or the next day for like a welcome assessment. So that's for the most part how people have got to us. Although, you know, our longer term plans are that, you know, people will come through the university counselling centres and ultimately that people will be able to come straight to us. But we're not quite there yet.
In terms of the work that you've done through zero suicide training, the way that you've worked in the past, the types of places that you've worked, when you've imagined how you hope to deliver this kind of suicide prevention work, mental health work in general, is this the future? Is this what you were hoping for? Is this the perfect kind of environment to create, do you think?
Well, yeah. You know, in a nutshell, it just is really different. You know, this isn't somewhere that we can support people, you know, everybody with every type of problem, but we've set this up in a way that it feels like a place that you can come and just, you know, I mean, we had a young guy who, I mean, he came to help set up the IT. He's nothing to do with James's Place, but he spoke to us about having experienced mental health problems of his own as a young man. I mean, he was a very young man when he came to when then, and he was talking about being seen in a porter cabin at the back of Bolton Hospital. And it was hot in the summer and freezing, and he just sort of said, you know, if I'd have been coming here, it would have felt really different. You know, often the guys who we've seen talk about, you know, feeling quite ashamed, feeling quite guilty, feeling sort of that they're not really worth anything. And even walking through the door here, I think the atmosphere and the building says, actually, you're worth this. You know, I'm describing something, you can't see it on the radio, I know, but it's like a lovely home. Lovelier than my own home, you know. But that's what it's supposed to be. Like I said, it's James's Place. It's a homely place where you can come and get help. But yeah, imagine if everybody got access to sort of this kind of environment.
It's great as well that it's happening here in Liverpool as well, because it kind of fits in with this idea that I've talked about for a long time, that Liverpool seems to be the home of new ideas when it comes to mental health, that people do want to do things a little bit differently in a way that I think if other cities looked in, they'd go, oh, actually, let's take a look at James's Place. Let's take a look at these other sort of organisations which are setting up as well. In terms of the future as well, you're already looking to bring in another therapist as well. So at what point do you think you'll be working at maximum capacity, if you like?
I think sort of in the new year, sort of after Christmas, we've kind of got these 6 months to really embed our intervention, to get everybody trained. I mean, I feel confident that we can help people now. But you know, we're at the top of the hill and rolling down slowly. I hope that by sort of January, February next year, these rooms will be used sort of 8 hours a day, that we'll be talking to the council about extending our planning permission to offer later sessions and weekend sessions, and that we will have, you know, between 20 and 30 guys a week sort of accessing support from us.
And just tell us about and Dan gave us a sense of it and a flavour of it before, just the severity or seriousness of the situation that these men are finding themselves in, that this is a crisis centre for those seriously at risk of suicide.
Yeah, I mean, what we know is, you know, I know the figures inside out, Mick. You know, nearly 6,000 people, you know, just over 6,000 people died last year, and about 4,500 people of the, you know, 4,500 of those were men. And of those 4,500, something like 3/4, 2/3 hadn't asked for any help because they didn't know how to, and or perhaps they'd had experience in the past when they'd asked for help that it hadn't been very forthcoming. So what we want to be able to provide, and that's why our goal is that this is a sort of a self-referral in the long term, is that the men of Liverpool and Merseyside, because we're not just saying this is about Liverpool, will hear about us and will know that this is somewhere where they can come and get help. And, you know, James had never had any mental health problems. He was a young, healthy, clever, beloved young man who had a crisis that was became massively anxious and distressed and overwhelmed and didn't know what to do with those feelings and died because of it. And already we're seeing, you know, a couple of the young men who've come here to spend time with us, we can see that pattern in them. And you know, Dan and I were sort of reflecting, you know, we were sort of discussing, you know, our clinical discussion. And, you know, James is so much in our mind because of what happened to him. But we're seeing young men who are experiencing very similar situations. From the outside, their crisis actually doesn't look that massive, but they feel completely overwhelmed by it, and it's eminently solvable when you give them a bit of time and some space and help them work through it. Like for James, if he'd have had this intervention, he would still be here, because his crisis wasn't that big. It was just he was overwhelmed by it.
I wonder whether or not, and you know, doing the job that I do and having the conversations that I do, that actually those the fact that the family had been so invested in that, putting James's name above the door, if you like, and on the mat, that what they're doing is they're saying, I know these stats say this, but these stats might be a little bit shocking, but you can't see the human beings, you can't see the individual. But putting James's name very much at the forefront goes, well, actually, of these 6,000, one of them is my son.
Yeah.
One of them might be your dad, your uncle, your brother, your granddad. And suddenly it becomes people, doesn't it? It becomes about people. And then suddenly you then start to think, all of these people are dying. And in virtually all of those cases, in many of those cases, it's unnecessary. They don't have to, as long as you can create an environment and get them in contact with services like this.
Yeah, and you know, the intervention, and I'll be able to show you it sort of when we're a little, maybe that's for another interview. The intervention that we're delivering, it isn't rocket science. It's underpinned by some really complex psychological theories, but it is essentially helping the person to understand what's going on. So why are you overwhelmed by this problem? Is it, you know, all these thoughts that you're having? No wonder you feel terrible if you've been walking around for a month feeling ashamed and guilty and like you're a bad person. I'd feel depressed if I was having those thoughts all the time. It's like, oh, right, okay. You know, I'm not normal. Actually, you are. It's dead normal to have these thoughts and feelings. You know, so for me, it's, you know, the intervention itself isn't that complex. It's just giving people time and space to let that happen and to let them understand what's happening. And you don't, you know, and with the best will in the world, I've never been able to do that in A&E when I used to work. I used to try and cram it into half an hour. And, you know, when I know that there are nurses and social workers and OTs running around Liverpool now trying to support people, but they're trying to support so many people with so many complex mental health problems as well, that just becomes almost impossible. You know, they're sort of, you know, but hey, they do a really good job. In Merseycare, since they started the Zero Suicide programme overall, they've seen over 10% reduction in their deaths by suicide. So in sort of over 2 years, I think that David Fernley reported at their board meeting recently that the reduction in deaths by suicide has been something like 13%. So that's gone from, you know, 22 people to 19. You know, that's three people who aren't dead because of the work that they've been doing.
Which is
It's amazing.
A brilliant result. Yeah, and it's I think of why zero suicide is although people might think that would never be achieved, it's a target. Yeah, because how do you get to that target? You reduce it a little bit, and you do it in the way that you've described. I look forward to hearing about the sort of the intervention techniques as well. We always liken mental health to physical health because it often helps people draw the comparison. But we've all been to the doctor with an issue where you're thinking, this is a terrible thing. This is going to be the end of me. This is going to be something which is not going to be treatable. And then the doctor, you come along and go, yeah, don't worry, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
I know, I understand, and actually this is what we're going to do to help. And actually, I guess when people hear that, they think, oh, right, this isn't something else which is going on in my head that only I understand, that nobody else can get a sense of. There are people who are trained. There are the doctors, the surgeons, the equivalents from the physical health world, which actually offer you this, and you can get it here.
Yeah, so this is what's happening. This is how you got it. This is what will stop it from happening again. There you go. And actually, I've seen 20 people in the last 2 months who've gone through the same. Oh, all right then. It just makes a sense of it. Once you understand stuff, you can deal with it, can't you? You know, you can make, you know, a lot of what we will be doing will be helping people to make sense of things that before they came to see us just felt kind of, you know, overwhelmed is the biggest kind of word that I hear quite a lot.
Jane, thank you very much for inviting us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Look forward to hearing about the continuing growth of James Place and the continued success of it as well. We wish you all the best and thanks for joining us for this very special Mental Health Monday.
Thank you very much, Mick.
And that was my whistle-stop tour of James's Place, which is doing wonderful, wonderful work to try and prevent suicide. And I was invited there ahead of World Suicide Prevention Day. We wish all the team there the very best of luck in the work that they do and hope that they continue to grow from strength to strength. There's loads of stuff, by the way, on social media, including videos of the visit too. You can see that for yourself. Check it out via @RadioCityTalk. Use the hashtag Mental Health Monday. Part two of the programme, though, now, here on Mental Health Monday, the World Suicide Prevention Day special. We've been hearing how Liverpool, as a city region, is adopting principles of the Zero Suicide Alliance. A special summit was held in the city, including the Metro Mayor, Steve Rotherham, and Luciana Berger, who is the MP for Wavertree and also a prominent campaigner when it comes to mental health. First up, let's hear from Luciana, speaking to our reporter Adam Phillips, on what the Zero Suicide Alliance is all about.
The Zero Suicide Alliance is something that we can be really proud of. It came out of our region and it's supported by lots and lots of different organisations right across the country, mental health organisations, charities, campaigners, people that are bereaved by suicide, all the ambition of doing everything possible to actually get rid of suicide altogether, zero suicide. That's the ambition, that's the goal. And within it, there's some really, really exciting and accessible, free training for people to do. It takes less than half an hour to complete. And it's a bit of training that provides people with the tools and the language to know what to do if they or we at any point encounter someone that might be experiencing suicidal thoughts or suicidal ideation. It is a really, really serious challenge for us right across the country. You know, just under 6,000 people took their life in the last year. And actually across Merseyside, we've got some of the highest levels of suicide per population level. So for so many reasons, it's fantastic to see people brought together today that are going to think about actually ensuring all of their staff complete this training. And we've got some really big workplaces represented, including Liverpool Football Club. And I'm really excited that we're doing something really positive and constructive in advance of World Suicide Prevention Day to address this issue.
How big of a role do businesses and business leaders, business groups have to tackle this really serious and important issue of mental health?
So mental health affects us all, and at any moment any one of us could see our mental health negatively affected. That could be as a young person growing up in school or college or university, it could be within a community, but not a surprise that people in the workplace are affected as well. And so we all have a responsibility to be talking about mental health, to having it out in the open. We know there's some really fantastic workplaces that are doing so much in this area already. I know one of my workplaces on the Wavertree Technology Park does some really fantastic things with all of its staff, thousands of staff, around mindfulness and about talking about mental health and training managers to know how to spot the signs and to support their staff. It's something that we're becoming alive to, but we are on a journey and we're not quite there yet. So this is just one initiative which is seeking to encourage employers in our region, right across the region, in the Liverpool City region, to take this issue seriously and also to give them the practical, free tools to support all of their staff in that endeavour.
It's an incredible target, isn't it? But how realistic of an ambition do you believe it could be?
I don't believe that any suicide is inevitable. And if you believe that, then we should be doing everything possible to prevent someone tragically taking their life. And I'm very, very aware that zero suicide is a tough ask, you know, a big goal. But I think we're absolutely right to have it. Because without, you know, without having that ambition of zero suicide, then, you know, if we're saying that, well, actually a few suicides are okay, actually no, you know, we should be doing everything possible to support people earlier on. And that's why I think this is the right goal to have.
Like you said, the conversations are starting right here on Merseyside. What do you think it would say to the rest of the country to say that this is our ambition here in this region to make sure that we're trying to eradicate suicide? That's the main objective, isn't it?
Well, once again, it's the Liverpool City region, it's Merseyside leading the way. And again, I'm so proud to be a part of this. I'm working alongside our Metro Mayor, Steve Rotherham. I serve as his mental health advisor. And with us, we've got so many organisations, including Merseycare, who's one of the founding members of the Zero Suicide Alliance, our local mental health trust for this region, again, who's leading the way. And we know that the work that our mental health trust has done has certainly been rolled out and picked up by other parts of the country when it comes to mental health services themselves. This is obviously broader and it's about what our employers can do. I think if we get, as I anticipate, a number of employers signing up today to ensuring all their staff complete this training, that will be a shining example to many employers across the country and other city regions to think about also adopting and having that ambitious aim of having zero suicide in their city regions as well.
And you mentioned big companies like Liverpool, big organisations like Liverpool are here today. If big groups get on board with this campaign, this initiative, do you hope to see a domino effect right across the region as well?
Very much so. You know, we've got to start somewhere. We've got loads of people here today. I'm so excited to see so many different organisations and companies and businesses and charities represented. That's fantastic. But obviously there's more beyond this room. So of course they will serve as an example to others across our city region about what can be done. Some people obviously, you know, can't always make an event. But the fact that we've got so many here today is really, really exciting.
When you speak to businesses, what's been the response about this initiative and the kind of things that you'd like to see implemented in the workplace as well?
The employers and companies and businesses that I've spoken to and charities and organisations are really delighted that there's actually something practical that they can do and that it doesn't cost them anything and that in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's going to take up less than half an hour of each staff member's time to complete. So it's something very tangible. It's going to see actions at the end of it. And even if we're able to reduce suicide by, you know, a few within the city region as a result of this, that for me is something to be welcomed. But obviously, ultimately, we have the ambition of zero suicide across our city region.
It sounds like a really great initiative. Wavertree MP Luciana Berger, thanks very much for joining us on Mental Health Monday.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Labour MP, Luciana Berger, passionate talker when it comes to all matters mental health. Great to get her back on this programme for the World Suicide Prevention Day special of Mental Health Monday. Also working hard when it comes to the Zero Suicide Alliance and trying to reduce suicides on Merseyside down to zero, the Chief Exec of Merseycare, Joe Rafferty. He's been speaking to Adam Phillips at the same summit, and he says that actually trying to reduce the number of suicides is something that Merseycare have been keen to do for a number of years now.
We started around the late end of 2015, and a couple of big things I think have happened. I mean, suicide's a complicated issue, so to reduce suicide numbers, you know, takes time. But in Merseycare itself, we are starting to see the number of people dying by suicide reduce, which is a hugely important issue for us. We're working through those numbers to make sure that we get them absolutely right and so on. But the key message would be we're seeing our suicide rate reduce. Now, I'd love it to reduce much faster than it's currently reducing. You know, where we stand, everybody, every single death by suicide is one too many. But it's moving in the right direction.
The other
What kind of things have you implemented as part of this initiative, this campaign in the workplace that you've really seen that has really benefited people, making people open up more about their mental health? And obviously, like you said, that all important, reduce those numbers that you see.
So some of the biggest impact things that we've been doing is, first of all, we've trained a huge number of our staff in basic suicide awareness. So a little tool called Sign Signpost, which is freely available. You can do it on your mobile phone, and it's incredibly impactful. So even in a mental health trust, we've been saying to people, don't be afraid to talk to people if they're expressing suicidal thoughts. In fact, it protects them. It doesn't increase the risk of suicide. So right across our organisation now, we've got people who are really aware of this. But we've done other significant things. We've been building safety plans with patients, really understanding the triggers that may make them think with a higher level of suicidal intention and so on. Really understanding that and then closing those opportunities down by making sure we get support around people at the right time. And we've also been working really, really hard on new ways to engage with people in their own healthcare. So we've got a lot of digital opportunities that they're still at the sort of development stage, but that will help people care better for themselves. But really for us, one of the big things that has happened is, you see today, you know, the Metro Mayor Steve Rotherham and Luciana Berger, the mental health lead, say that it's time actually to take some of the learning and some of the campaigning stuff that we've been doing in the Trust and take it out to the rest of Merseyside. Because we know that the simple conversation itself will protect people. It not only protects people, but it protects communities. Because, you know, when one person dies by suicide, that's a very individual tragedy. But we know on average about 300 people are deeply affected by each individual suicide. Those may be children, so education gets disturbed. It can be brothers, sisters, relatives who don't go to work anymore. So to come back to the point about businesses being here, you know, this is a way to protect our communities, to protect our workforce, to make sure they're as healthy as possible. And every single death by suicide costs the public purse about £1.5 million. So saving one life saves £1.5 million, as well as saving the life, of course. And for businesses, that's tremendously important, because that keeps people at work, that keeps economic productivity. All of those things are about building safe, effective communities. And I think it's wonderful that Steve and Luciana have stepped out and had the courage to do this. They're one of a small number now of elected officials, New York, Toronto, possibly London, who'll come ahead and say, we want to eradicate suicide in our population. And that puts us in a really leading place. And I'm proud to be a small part of that.
Do you feel that Merseyside, with this initiative, is truly leading the way in tackling the stigma surrounding mental health and obviously getting people to talk about it, which we hear so often as well?
Yeah, I think Merseyside's a real leading light in so many respects. I mean, we've got, of course, the zero suicide approach, but the fact that I'm talking to you now about a mental health hour that goes out on the radio, I think is an astonishing thing. That in itself is an indication of how we're seeing this groundswell of recognition that we simply cannot walk by the impact that mental health has on people's lives. And, you know, really, really brilliantly here today, we haven't even started this morning, and we've had three businesses come up and give their cards and say, we want to know more about this. So I think we're pushing against an open door in Merseyside. It'll make us a better population. You know, from an economic perspective, it will make us look like a more attractive place to come and live, because areas with lower suicide tend to be places where people have got really great, not just great mental health services, but good mental health in their own right. It's an indication of good well-being. And I think Merseyside's really up for that.
Something to be proud of as well.
I think it's not just to be proud of. I think, you know, once we start doing these things and connecting them, I think it's something we should shout about loudly. Because, as I said, there are only a small number of conurbations across the world who've had the nerve to say, actually, we want to eradicate suicide from our population. And this region has a long history of leading innovation and change right from the Industrial Revolution, in fact. And I think this is a new revolution. This is a new revolution in healthcare that's starting to say it's no longer acceptable for 6,000 people every year across England to die in despair and loneliness. And big message here, Nobody wants to die by suicide. They can't cope with the pain any longer. What they want to do is live better. And that's the message out of this. If we help people live better, then we will help people die less by suicide. And we'll help them live better by having great infrastructure, great jobs, great education and great health services.
Joe Rafferty, Chief Exec of Merseycare, and our reporter Adam Phillips at that special summit, the Zero Suicide Alliance Summit, taking place in Liverpool, organised by various people, among them the Metro Mayor of the Liverpool City Region, Steve Rotherham. Brilliant to see that as Mental Health Monday is based in Liverpool, Liverpool is, as a city region, doing wonderful work to try and reduce suicides. And on this World Suicide Day, it's great to see the city taking lead on that issue. Thank you to everybody involved in the programme today. Thanks to the team at James's Place. Thanks to those who invited us down to that Zero Suicide Alliance Summit in Liverpool as well. If you want to get involved on the show, you can do. mick@radiocity.co.uk is my email address. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. Don't forget to check out on social media the videos as well from James's Place as well. They're up and about on social media. Use the hashtag and look for the hashtag Mental Health Monday.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
On Radio City Talk.